Again, a good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to eInform.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. For any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us, and we do want you to participate in this discussion. Now, if you need assistance, please select Help Desk from the drop-down options in the Q&A panel, and our associate, Lori Weber, will try to assist you via private messaging. Now, today's topic is an update on the implementation of the Biggert Waters Flood Insurance Reform Act of 2012, with a focus on the changes to flood insurance premiums that will be taking effect in the months and years to come. First, for the benefits of our newcomers, we will be starting with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you to hold off submitting your questions until we do get to that part of the program. Now, today's recording and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later this afternoon, and then a transcript will be available early next week. Now, it is my great pleasure to welcome back David Miller, Associate Administrator of the Federal Insurance and Mitigation Administration. Prior to joining FEMA, David had a long history of experience as a state and local emergency manager and served as a state director for Iowa when they had the floods up there. Also joining us for the first time is the Senior Advisor, Kristen Robinson, who is leading the team coordinating the implementation of this legislation. Kristen previously worked for NEMA for several years on legislative efforts, including getting increases to emergency management capacity building programs and support for EOC construction. Please do refer to today's background page for further biographical details and links to several related resources, including a new webpage for the Act at FEMA.gov, which now includes a number of fact sheets, and as well as a couple of other summaries. Welcome to you both, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. And I now turn the floor over to David to start us off, please.
Thanks, Amy. Good afternoon, everyone, for those that are in the afternoon. I guess some are still morning. We're going to talk today, as Amy said, a little bit about the Biggert Waters Insurance Reform Act of 2012. We're going to talk primarily about premium increases, but also give you a little background into where we're going. And how we got there. And then the other part of this is a couple pointers on how to buy down both the risk and the cost of those premiums. Kristen's with me today, and she's going to help me advance slides, and I'm going to talk and hopefully give us enough time to answer questions as well. In July of 2012, Congress passed the Biggert Waters Flood Insurance Reform Act, as we refer to it. It was signed by the President on July 6, 2012, and we've been in the process of implementing it ever since. Matter of fact, there were a couple things that we implemented right away. One of them had to do with, frankly, the waiting period for insurance to go into effect. There are a couple exemptions to that, and another exemption was granted for people that were affected by a fire on federal land with flooding on federal land that exacerbated flooding downstream. If you want to know more about that, we can get you information on that. But it tells you that the act went into effect immediately, and at the same time, it's going to happen over a period of years, and we're going to talk about the premium increases. One of the things that prompted the act is actually twofold. The first thing was we were looking for stability in the NFIP program, and what we were hearing from all of our stakeholders is they were looking for a longer-term reauthorization. We were seeing it in fits and starts and short-term reauthorizations of the NFIP. And when it wasn't authorized, we saw adverse effects on the housing industry, because if you were required to have insurance as part of your federally backed mortgage and insurance wasn't available, it stopped those processes. So in effect, interruptions of the NFIP were more than disruptive. They had financial impacts. Stakeholders came together, I think a little bit to our surprise, but thankful to Congress and the President, we got a 5-year reauthorization. The other part of the NFIP was to stabilize the program financially. We're looking at to put it on financially stronger footing, this is the first effort to do that. Many of you recall that we borrowed a lot of money, especially relative to Hurricane Katrina. The program was in debt, although we were paying off that debt, both the interest and the premium. But we needed to be on sounder financial footing, and then this year as we got into Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy, the truth is we had to borrow more money again, and it shows once again that we needed more financial stability in the program. One way Congress made changes to strengthen the program financially is to require us to begin charging premium rates that reflect true risk. And we'll talk about what that means in just a minute. The rate changes are going to impact a number of policyholders over time. I want to provide you some details over that. At the end of the day, over a period of years, almost everybody will be affected one way or the other. What's key here is when you're going to be affected, what the triggering mechanisms are, and the kind of increases that we may see in premium costs over time. Next slide, please. So what's changing? There are things that everyone affected by flooding or significant flood risk or risk of flooding need to know. The flood insurance rates, again, are changing. If you received subsidies, and this is the key, if you received subsidies or discounts in the past, you'll no longer be able to rely on those subsidized or discounted rates to keep premiums artificially low. Remember, this was the intent of Congress, is that the premiums needed to reflect the risk, and we needed to move there over a period of time. So those rates are going to more accurately reflect the actual risk. We'll be relooking at actuarial tables. There'll be a publishing of the new actuarial tables in a number of areas beginning in June. And so you'll see not only an increase, a removal of the subsidies, but you're going to see the actuarial tables change as well. And we'll talk about how all that rolls together. Again, it's not going to affect everyone at the same time. And we'll really talk about two sections today, Section 205 of the law and Section 207, and what they mean and how they will be implemented. Important to note the things that affect risk. One of the things in bigger waters that we talk about in getting to the actuary risk is how we calculate that. I'm not going to focus today on the studies that we need to do and where we're going, but there are 16 areas of studies in bigger waters. Part of it is also to look at future conditions and incorporate them into our risk and risk analysis. That can be the weather patterns, erosion, development, and key factors. It may be at some point climate adaptability. There are a number of things that we're required to look at over a period of time. We're not quite sure how we're going to do it, but I think over a period of years you'll see those things be built more and more into our actuarial rates and tables. Next slide, please. So who's going to be affected? Let's look at who will be affected by changes beginning in 2013. Not everyone who has flood insurance policy will be affected by Biggert Waters Act changes. The Act only requires the NFIP to phase out subsidies in certain public cases, or in certain specific cases. Subsidized rates are used when properties were constructed or substantially improved either before December 31, 1974, or the effective date of the initial local flood insurance rate map, or what we call firm maps. So if your home or property is older than the firm, chances are good that you're receiving a subsidized rate. Pre-firm properties that do get a subsidy represent only between 40% and 45% of the full risk premium rate. So they're paying pennies on the dollar. Owners of residential property that is not a primary residence, and this is the first trigger, folks, owners of residential properties that are not a primary residence and they're located in the special flood hazard area, or what many people refer to as the 100-year floodplain, will see or have seen and begun to see a 25% annual increase until rates reflect their true risk. That began on January 1st of this year. Again, for those of you that deal with this issue especially, non-primary residences received a 25% annual increase and they'll continue to receive 25% annual increases until their rates reflect the true risk. And that began on January 1st. It comes up in the renewal processes of their policy. Folks, one of the keys here, because it's been confusing, is there's a discussion that it's 25% for a period of 4 years and then I'm at my full rate. The problem is it's 25% of the rate you pay now until you get to your full rate. And the fact is the actuarial rate for your property may also change and may increase as we do new rate tables in June. So it's just not over a four-year period. It may be extended much longer than that. This is under Section 205. Owners of property which has experienced severe or repeated flooding. And if you want to look at the code itself, there's a definition for severe repetitive loss and repetitive loss properties. Or that have incurred flooding cumulative damage with flood insurance payments exceeding the value of the structure. Those are the next ones. They'll see a 25% rate increase annually until the rates reflect the true risk. That will begin in late 2013. We have some work that we need to do in this area, plus the dialogue and the arrangement that we have with the Write Your Own Company so we can do proper notice to them. They need to involve it in their business practices, so you won't see that rate increase kick in until later this year, probably as late as October. Next slide. One thing before I move on, the owners of business properties in the special flood hazard area, again, we're talking about businesses now, they'll see a 25% rate increase annually until they reflect true risk rates, again, beginning in late 2013. And then owners of substantially damaged or substantially improved subsidized properties will see a 25% rate increase later this year as well. So those are really the Section 205 increases that we're implementing now. One of the keys here is you have to remember, and many people don't know, the subsidized rates for the NFIP of the 5.6 million policyholders we own. Subsidized rates only are reflected in about 20% of our policies. So we don't have a whole lot of people affected at one time, and this gets phased in. The other one is to remember that owners of primary residences in a special flood hazard area will be able to keep their subsidized rates. Again, primary residences will be able to keep their subsidized rates until a couple things happen. Either they sell their property, and which means if I sell my property, the new property owner doesn't get phased in over time. They go to the new actuarial rate right away. They'll pay the full actuarial cost, and as actuarial tables change, their rates will increase accordingly. But they're going to feel it right at the front end if the buyer of property will. If you already have a flood insurance policy and you allow it to lapse and then want to rejoin the NFIP, again, you will not be phased in. You'll feel the full actuarial rate at the time you look to repurchase. If you suffer severe and repeated flood losses, you're going to see you're in. Hold on just a second. Oh, yeah, you keep your subsidized rate until you suffer severe or repeated flood losses. If you purchase your policy after July 6, 2012, that's the effective date of the law. So if you're a new purchaser of policy after July 6, you'll get the full actuarial rates. And then there's a provision in the law is if you've refused an offer to mitigate flood losses to your property. And there's some nuances there that we're working through about what that means and how that offer is tended, whether it's a whole mitigation offer, which includes HMGP and other mitigation offers, or if it's under the flood insurance program, and we think it's the latter. You're made an offer under the grants that are under the flood insurance program, so FMA, severe repetitive loss, then you refuse that offer, then you're going to see your rates increase significantly. I think those are some key triggers there. Next slide. So again, when will the changes occur? They've already begun. Full risk rates will apply to property not previously insured, newly purchased, or to a policy which is purchased after a lapse. Premiums for older pre-firm or non-primary residences in the special flood hazard area, that's already begun at 25% a year until they reach the full actuarial rate. Then again, later this year, we'll do premiums for pre-firm business properties, pre-flood insurance rate map business properties, severe repetitive loss properties, and properties where claims payments exceed the fair market value. They'll all see increases by 25% a year until they reach the full actuarial rate. And then normal rate revisions will actually occur this year. Guys, under the previous law, we were allowed to raise premiums at the rate of 10% a year, and that was on average. What we're looking at this year, especially those, this is a little tough to explain. If you're in the 25% and you're getting kicked up, this has already been built in. For those that aren't, they may also see a rate increase of probably about a little over 5% on average this year. Part of that is because we're required by Biggert Waters to establish a reserve fund for future payments of claims, and we will be doing that. And then later in 2014, premiums for properties affected by MAP changes will increase over 5 years at the rate of 20% per year, and that is over 5 years until they reach their full risk rate. Guys, that last one we call Section 207. If you look at 207 in the law, it talks about MAP and MAP changes. We don't expect MAP and MAP changes to take effect until late calendar year 2014 or federal fiscal year 15. We have a lot of work to do in this area about what MAP changes means, how they will be incorporated, who gets affected at what time. There's a lot of discussion that we have to do on implementing that provision of the law. And I think right now that gets confused in a lot of dialogues where there's flooding going on. We are in the process of mapping or remapping now. Even though that may be occurring in many jurisdictions, the truth is you're not going to see the effect of the Biggert Waters in Section 207. You're not going to see the effect of that take place until late 2014 or federal fiscal year 15. Next slide, please. So why the changes in the NFIP? I want to go back and talk about it. A number of things have happened. We're seeing increased risk in the United States, that it's so serious that insurance companies, you've got to remember when the NFIP was started, they refused to insure because they couldn't get a real handle on the calculation of risk. So in 1968, Congress created the NFIP. What we're seeing under Biggert Waters and others is changes in what we know, when we know it, how the insurance industry may enter into this. One of the things that we're talking about, one of the things we're required to study, is what's the proper role for government in the NFIP? What role can private insurers and reinsurers play in this market? That also is in Biggert Waters. Communities that joined the program had to adopt minimum standards for new construction so that homes would be less at risk. We had to do floodplain management in many of the areas, and we're seeing that evolve as well as we begin to consider risk and risk management and what that does to the actuarial tables and rates. One of the things that's going on right now as we do and try to accumulate best available data in an area that influenced the flood insurance rate maps is really a discussion on how we share that information and how we use it to inform community decision making, and then also how it influenced the rates. You're hearing a lot of discussion these days in many communities about how we may build in climate adaptation or climate change into the rate setting. That's still up in the air for any number of reasons. It is one of the things that we're looking at right now. We're not using it to inform the actuarial tables or the rates, but it is another area that we're required to study and look at and build into our structures. So it is coming into the future. Next slide, please. last thing on my list is what can I do to lower the cost? Right now, part of the issue with bigger waters is one of the things that Congress did not do is address the affordability piece. So a lot of the conversations you're hearing in the communities have to do with the amount of the rate increase, what it's going to mean to me. If they come in and remap me and I'm now in an A zone or a velocity zone, which means I'm in the highest risk areas, my premiums are going to go up so high I can't afford to live here anymore, or you've devalued my property and I can't sell my property with this hanging over it. Congress did not address those affordability issues. We've been asked to study it, and we're going to engage in the contracts and the efforts to do that. I think with the amount of activity that's going on now, Congress may re-enjoin this conversation on affordability, and we may see action in this area sooner rather than later. But again, I'll say it's iffy and it's up in the air. Our requirement in Biggert Waters is to study the affordability issue. We'll do that study and issue our findings at a later date. In the meantime, there's only a couple things folks can do. One is it has to do, if you're a homeowner or a business, it has to do with where you build and how you build and what you've done to mitigate losses, whether you've flood-proofed your property, whether you've elevated your property. That has an effect on the premium you will pay and how you buy down. In order to know how much you need to elevate in how you walk through this process, one of the things that especially subsidized property owners never had is they never had an idea of their base flood elevation relative to the map. Why? Because they were subsidized and they didn't need the information. You're going to see a renewed emphasis in this area about knowing your base flood elevation, knowing where you are relative to the map. That means getting an elevation certificate. That means actually having to spend money to go out and get the engineers and the people to plot your property to know where you sit relative to the elevation. Now, that can cost as little as a couple hundred dollars, or it can cost a lot of money depending on the work, the engineers, and the points of reference they have that they need to do to figure out where you are relative to base flood elevation. So you're going to hear a lot of discussion about elevation certificates over the coming months. But again, building relative to that will help reduce your cost for the insurance premium. The other thing that's becoming more known, and I think we have a little over 1,200 communities in the program, is our CRS program, the Community Rating System. It is an effort to go beyond the minimums of the NFIP regulation, beyond the minimums of local ordinance that we ask you to pass to participate in the flood in the NFIP. There is a program that we have that helps buy down that risk in a number of categories. And as you meet certain levels of that by planning, by regulation, community effort, you have the ability to buy down the insurance rates for your community in increments of about 5% for each level that you're at. And again, that's something that we hope communities look at. It has to do with build our floodplain management, building code enforcement, how you do your permitting, the level of planning you have. There are a number of factors that are in the CRS program. You can find information on the CRS program on FEMA's website. So with that, that covers most of what I have. Kristen and I are here, and we are open for questions, Amy.
Okay, that's great, David. Thank you so much for that introduction. We'll get our Q&A instructions up here. One moment. Okay, I am going to go ahead and close the chat window at this time, just so you don't get confused about which window to put it in. We do ask you to put your question in the Q&A panel, and please select host for to submit it to. And then I will moderate those questions as they come in, and we'll pretty much take them in order, and I will read the question aloud, and then our guests will respond via the bridge. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise and reasonably general in nature. I'm going to put up at the end of the program an email address where you can write for, you know, specific questions you may have and follow up offline. Now, we are ready to begin, so please enter your comment or question at any time, and we have several already. Okay, the first one from Alan Ma. He says, will the transfer of an existing flood policy to a new property owner affect the flood insurance rate?
The answer to that is yes. It actually isn't that it's a reissue of the policy. When you sell your property, what will happen is you go in, if you have a federally backed mortgage, you'll go in, they'll tell you that you're required to have flood insurance. You'll meet with your agent, or the mortgage company may force place you. You'll meet with an insurance agent that offers, either through the direct service or write your own company that offers our rates. But rather than go to a subsidized rate in that area, you'll get the full actuarial rate as the actuarial tables exist now. You'll get that full rate as the new property owner.
Okay. Robert McAleer, and everyone, forgive me for butchering any names here, but he asked, if a property owner has flood insurance as an extra precaution, but the property is not located in the 100-year flood zone or the special flood hazard area, will the premiums increase for that property owner, or will the property owner have to pay the 5% assessment for the reserve fund?
When we talk about the 5% assessment for the reserve fund, that's where they're actually going to see their increases. We have to accommodate that. At the end of the day, when we remove all the subsidies, folks, there's still a provision in Biggert Waters that allows us to have our rates reflect what the new costs are as we continue down the road. Rather than do that at the old 10% rate on average, they're actually allowing us to go to the 20% rate. So in answer to your question, those people that live outside of the special flood hazard area, are they going to see rate increases? The answer is yes. Part of that rate increase will be used for the reserve fund, and this year we expect it to be a little over 5%, and then 5% of that will go into the reserve.
Okay, but you're not implementing 20% across the board at this point.
Right, right. Remember, the 25% has to do with removal of subsidies from a number of properties in the special flood hazard area, and the 20% increases have to do with if you're remapped and the zones change, then you'll begin to see the 20% increases over a period of 5 years. So I guess the latter part of the answer, Amy, is if you get a map change after we do the mapping, and remember that's in late 2014, when we set all the rules and the information about that, if you see a map change after that period, depending on how you're mapped and what that means, you may see 20% increases until you reach your full actuarial rate for a period of 5 years.
Okay, very good. We have a good question from Joy Brooks. Wanted to make sure that this one got answered. And she asked, will there be direct outreach from FEMA to affected property owners?
In probably a less direct way than you may have happened. We are already doing outreach, again, through forums like this. We've done some congressional briefs. We're working with regions and those people who execute the program. But the most direct thing that people will feel is when they talk to their insurance agent, when you feel those inquiries, and a lot's being written about the flood insurance program now, but as you get ready to do the renewals, as we do more press information from external affairs, we brief congressionals, we have that interaction with communities that we always have, especially with regard to mapping and remapping. Those are the dynamics you're going to see. But if you really want to know how you're going to be affected and you really want to know the outreach part of this, it's sitting down with your insurance agent and saying, how is this going to affect me? Is it going to affect me now or is it coming later? And what's it going to do my premiums? Again, one of the things you may want to do in preparation of that and knowing how you personally are going to be affected, and this is an outreach that we want to do as well, is really knowing what your elevation is relative to the base flood elevation. Elevation certificates are going to be a big topic of discussion. That's already beginning, and it'll be part of the community dialogue.
Very good. And I've got a question specifically related to that from Timothy Troutman, who says, under BW-12, what will rating assumptions be if a property owner does not have an elevation certificate? Or what would be the impact?
Yeah, if this is the way, I don't want to avoid this. I'm trying to think of how to explain it. Maybe Kristen can help me here. What happens is it's the assumption is that the map is correct. And what happens is our maps that we build are based on some assumptions and assumptions of flooding anyway. And you really need to sit down in the community and with the engineers about the preciseness of our maps, how they're built, what assumptions go into them, what elevations we look at, the data we look at to produce the map. What we know is there's some gradation of error in there, and they're not as precise as some people would like them to be. The only way to know if the map is really correct is to know what your elevation is relative to the map. Otherwise, it's a more generalized approach.
And each property is going to be rated differently based on their elevation as it's assessed. So to have that level of precision through an elevation certificate could ultimately help a homeowner to lower their premiums or to understand what actions that they have to take to mitigate for a good return on investment for that mitigation activity.
Thank you. I've got a question from Gary Gray that others that have joined us a little bit later may want to know, and I'll go ahead and take it. He is asking whether or not we can email the PowerPoint presentation to everyone here today. And basically the answer to that is we will have it posted on our website later today. That's www.emforum.org. We do have a mailing list there you can get on, and next Monday there will be an email that goes out with links to all materials. And then finally, you can actually save, when you exit, you might be presented with an option to whether or not you would like to save the files from today, and you can select yes, and then it's a good idea to select the PDF format, and that way you don't need another plugin. Okay, let's see. I've got one from – I'm going to ask one real quick. You know, as you mentioned, David, the secondary residences, those increases started – that went into effect this past January. They're going to be hit with another 25% this next January. After that went into effect this past January, did you see a noticeable – drops in coverage? In other words, a noticeable blip in cancellations?
We don't know the answer to that one yet, Amy.
Okay.
One of the things that we want to look at, and we want to work with the companies that are doing policies to look at what our drop rates are. One of the things, you remember, Congress asked us to put financial stability into the program and make the rates reflect the risk. At the end of the day, part of that was as we increased policyholders, we'd get more financial stability in the program as well.
Exactly.
At the end of the day, if we have policy drops, depending on who drops and why they drop and what we're asked to do, again, it'll be more than a little disconcerting to us, and we'll have to figure out what that means about the financial stability of the program. I think, though, that part of the answer in that, and again, we're seeing the I guess for lack of a better term, the volatility of the discussion, we're seeing that it is the discussion of the rates, what they will be, is having an effect on insurance. We don't know what it's going to do to the fund overall, but it may force Congress into talking about the affordability issue even before our study is completed.
And relating back to the outreach question, and perhaps Kristen, might be a specialist in this. Is there outreach happening or planned to the governors in the states?
Yes, we already did that as part of the briefing we were doing last week. We're working with each of the FEMA regions. We talked to the regional administrations plus the regional administrators plus the federal insurance and mitigation staff within those regions to do outreach with the governors and then continue to do the outreach with the communities as well. We really want the governors aware of it. I think part of the disconnect in the past is states don't regulate the flood insurance program. So you have a little disconnect about how they buy in, what they know, and how it affects their communities. That's of concern to us. We want to make sure they know about it because frankly, a lot of the calls are going to go back through their offices, and we want them equipped with the information they need to respond appropriately.
Exactly. Question, interesting question from Laura Caton, who asks, should floodplain managers be aware of the CRS program? And I'd like to expand that a little bit to maybe be, should elected officials be aware of the CRS program?
Yeah, they should. Matter of fact, I used to sit on the National Advisory Council. I remember one of the members there from Florida. They were a member of the CRS, and he asked why more communities weren't in it and what they knew about it. I think the challenge for all of us is a constant re-education as we see rollover in officials and what they're aware of and how we brief them. And amongst all the things that they have to hear about, whether it's a governor, a legislator, a mayor, a county supervisor, a commissioner, it's one that you have to keep talking about bringing up. I think the other part of that, though, this is a lot of times when you get into CRS or into the flood insurance program overall, these aren't five-minute elevator speeches. This is complex stuff. So getting the time, getting their attention, telling them how it's going to affect their community, especially when you're doing that when flooding hasn't happened or they haven't had an event in a while, those are sometimes difficult conversations, and it's an area that we need to do better in.
Very good. Let's see. Stephen Pyle asks, could you explain why owners of secondary residences and business properties will see increases in the SFHA, but primary residents will not unless they meet the 4 or 5 criteria?
I wish I knew all the answers to that. But part of it is conjecture in our part.
Yeah.
I think as we watched and others watched the congressional debate, the thought on secondary residences and in some of the businesses is they could absorb the cost. If you could afford a secondary residence, then you could afford the removal of your subsidy. Now, that may not always be true, but I have a feeling that was part of the discussion in Congress. Primary residences, I think, get into a lot of discussion about why people are there, what's the value of the property, are they there because their community placed them there, and that's the house they can afford at the time. There's a lot of discussion points that go beyond that one. All I can tell you is this is the action that Congress took, and we're going to follow their instructions on implementation.
Right, and on the businesses, I gather you need some further definition of that. What constitutes a business?
No, I think we will, and there'll be some clarifying there. I think it really gets down to as we go through it, and I'll have to talk to the insurance people and the write your own companies. It probably has to do with the way we offer policy and whether we insure them as a business or as a resident, and that may be the definition that's used.
Okay. Richard Yazbeck asks, is the requirement for flood insurance, mandatory flood insurance, still tied to a federally insured mortgage under the new law, or are coverage requirements going to be expanded beyond those with such a mortgage?
The answer to the first part of the question is yes, that's still there, federally backed mortgages, if you're in the special flood hazard area, require coverage. It's an interesting thing that it's always said that FEMA requires this. And it's actually a provision of the Act, and what you'll find is mortgage companies require it if you're in the special flood hazard area, and if you don't buy it, they'll force place it. Force place insurance usually is much higher than what we charge, and although we may say that change with the removal of subsidies. So that's part of that discussion. Will we see mandatory purchase expand? I don't know the answer to that. One of the things that we're asked to study is the proper role of government insurance in a roundabout way. What's the role of private industry in this? How are they going to compete? How are they going to sell product? I think as we study this issue and we talk to the insurance industry and the reinsurance industry, we're going to see different influences on how we look at policies, how we look at risk and risk analysis relative to policies, and there will probably be some discussion on what mandatory purchase means or doesn't mean as we walk through this. We could see a contraction of the mandatory purchase. I would keep my eyes open on that one. It's a big topic of debate on risk and risk pool, who's in, who's out, how we spread the risk. That's an important piece of it as we talk to the insurance industry overall and how they may enter this business.
And do you have any data on how many of the policies in effect are mandatory, basically, versus voluntary?
I don't. We, again, of the 5.6 million policies we have, we know that about 19 to 20% of those are subsidized policies, but I'd have to look at the number that tells me how many are mandatory purchase.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's see. A couple questions back on CRS. Donna Godfrey asks, on average, what is the amount of the reduced premiums that a community may anticipate for its residents if it does participate in the CRS program, and how much manpower will it require on the part of the local government? And we don't want you to go into all the fine points, but as you mentioned, it's, 5% increments depending on what category you're in?
Yeah, there's a list of, I think, 19 areas, maybe more. I'd have to look at the CRS program, and I know we changed it a little bit last year. If you look at it, it's some relatively simple things. Matter of fact, a lot of communities don't even enter at the bottom level of it.
Right.
They've done floodplain management, adopted their ordinance, and do mitigation planning, and those things. They may have already bought one or two levels in the program at that 5% increment. As you get further on, though, and you manage and you do structural and non-structural mitigation stuff and you participate in your community, you'll see that those standards are a little tougher to make, albeit we only have a handful of communities that are at the highest rating, which I think is equal to about a 45% reduction in premium.
Yeah, that's the max, basically. But that's significant. So.
Yeah, it's very significant.
Yeah, and Laura Caton, just to kind of chime in on the same question, is wondering how long it might take a community to do the necessary things to qualify. And I guess this kind of goes back to how much manpower, how long, you know, what kind of effort is it there, and are there grants that will support that kind of work?
And the answer to both is it really has to do with, I think some communities, for instance, I was in Washington State last year as we awarded a CRS upgrade and certificate to one of the communities in Washington State. And I think in visiting with them afterwards, the one thing that I noted is it is not a local emergency manager's piece. It's not the local zoning guy's piece. It really is a community effort and a community dynamic to affect the CRS. In talking to the person that managed it, I think the effort is significant. What I gathered from them is they calculated it and looked at it an overall community benefit, not just what it did to the insurance rates, and that's what got them to buy in. But at the same time, there were some things that, frankly, from a cost-benefit analysis, they were choosing not to do. It required a substantial effort, and frankly, they just couldn't afford to go to that next step, at least not at this time. But they were going to keep plugging at it, looking at what they could do, and they used it as a way to better manage their community and make it more resilient.
That's the whole point, right?
That's the whole point. You know, we so often we talk about the insurance, the premiums, and the rates that we charge, and we miss the whole discussion on risk and what we can do to mitigate risk. And part of this really needs to be part of that discussion. When we go in and begin a conversation with a mapping effort that we have, too often it's focused on who's in, who's out of the special flood hazard area and what's my premium going to be, rather than a discussion of what the map shows relative to risk and what we can do to mitigate that risk, and that we don't have to bite it off all in one big bite. We can do it over a period of time. And the good news is that the insurance is available. The good news is we can buy down the premiums, and the good news is we can make our community more resilient if we take mitigative action.
Very good. Okay, David Vinge says in the New Jersey, New York area, and I'm sure it's going to pertain to other areas as well, advisory maps have been prepared by FEMA. If a community adopts these maps, is it considered the same as an update of the firm with respect to insurance rates?
The answer depends on your community. Let me walk through it, because ABFEs, advisory-based flood elevation maps, are key. We've offered them in the past. I think you saw them for the first time after Katrina, and I can't remember which state is what. One state used them to inform, which means local communities could adopt the ABFA, or they could choose not to, or they could choose to come somewhere in between where their current map was and what the ABFE said. In the other state, they decided to adopt the ABFEs as the new standard. What we're trying to do, and then we saw them play out differently as we had discussions in North Dakota. We saw them play out a little differently this last summer as we had discussions and ongoing mapping efforts in Louisiana. And then we get to New York and in New Jersey specifically in relative to Sandy. Let me say that the effort here, as we discussed ABFEs, is what we noted in many of those communities in New Jersey and New York, was that maps were as old as 1983, I think. They hadn't been updated in some areas for quite a while. What we knew as communities were planning to go forward is they did not have the best available data. We wanted to be able to project that forward so they could make informed decision-making on how they move forward. We knew that we hadn't gone through the whole process. Part of the advisory part of this is we want to apply the science. We need to do it within this small time frame. We want to inform the building and the effort, mark a point in time to move forward. But we also know that we hadn't gone through the whole process, the whole vetting process, and the ABFE is part of a community dialogue. Now, many of the communities are struggling with that. If you believe the ABFE is going to change significantly, and where we see the most variability in the data is in velocity zones in coastal areas, and of course that's a lot of what's affected in New York and New Jersey. As we see that, you may want to wait until there's a chance to completely vet the maps, have the ongoing discussion with the communities, get another layer of science in there and have the dialogue so you don't overbuild. In other areas, they want to get on with their building very soon. They want to know what to build to. And our discussion is if you want to know build to without having to wait for the data to come out, probably in another number of months, if not another year, you may want to look at the ABFEs and build to the ABFE. And because there's a variance in there, if you want to account for other things in it, you may want to do ABFE levels plus a foot or two of freeboard. Those are tough community discussions. They mean a lot of money. They mean a lot of investment. But again, ours is to inform the decision-making as we go through. Now, the other thing you'll see the federal government do, and this affects it, as we issue our grants, part of the discussion here with Secretary Donovan and others is what's the federal standard for rebuild where federal grant money is involved. And in New York and New Jersey, we're looking at ABFEs plus a foot of freeboard.
Interesting. Folks, we do have a lot of questions. If we do not get to yours, I mean, please be patient as we try to get to yours. If we don't, I'm going to, again, put up an email address here in just a bit where you can follow up on your own and or on our final feedback form. If you want to put your question in there, we can get those forwarded on. I think these two questions are related, David. Jack Brock, when the preliminary DFIRMs came out, if a property was identified within a floodplain that was not shown on previous firms, the property owner could get a reduced rate if they enrolled in the NFIP before the DFIRMs were approved. Is this still the case? And does this refer to that preferred risk policy extension? David? The second question is PRP still going to be offered by FEMA after January 1st, 2015?
The answer is, and I don't have the date, is we will be phasing out the preferred risk policy. You'll see increases in those areas as well.
Right.
What I don't have in front of me right now is the wind.
Okay.
But will we see increases in that area? Again, the answer is yes. the other question, though, I want to go back and try to understand. Ask me that long question again, because it has to do with where you live, how you build, and when you come into the program.
Okay, you should be able to see it in the Q&A panel.
My system logged me off, so hold on.
Oh, no. Okay. This had to do with a previous policy where preliminary deferms came out. If the property was then moved into, you know, the flood plain, the property owner could get a reduced rate if they enrolled in the NFIP before the deferms were finally approved.
And the answer is that going to be extended? In a way, you got to remember there's two triggers here. One is the subsidies for special flood hazard area and the non-primary residences and the businesses and those things we talked about. The other is the 207 changes that come with mapping. I think one of the things that's going on now, if you want to protect the rate that you have on now before we go to mapping and before we have new actuarial tables that we're looking at in June, is if you're in the middle of mapping and we haven't gone to the new increases and don't know how we're going to get there, remember that's in late 2014, federal fiscal year 15. At least if you adopted your maps now and you were in the mapping, you're going to see those rates stay there until we remap at a later date, and then you'll see those increases go to the full actuarial rate. So I realize it's kind of a trick answer, and there are some timing issues there, but there's timings about when you map, when the new actuarial tables come out, whether we put the mapping provisions of 207 in place yet or not. There are some timing issues there. Simple answer is if you're going to look at map and map changes, 207 will be a driver in that, and it will not become effective until late 2014. I hope that answers the question, but if we want to get into more depth, again, Amy, you're going to have the address for us, and I can get the right technical people on it.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. We are getting short on time. Let's see. I have a question on flood zone D. Alan Ma says, will properties newly brought into flood zone D be phased into the higher insurance rate similar to phasing of properties brought into the SFHA?
I don't know the answer to that, but let's capture the question and I'll find the answer in response.
Okay, go. And another follow-up on the CRS communities. Michelle asks, will policyholders within CRS communities continue to receive the discount associated with the community's CRS rating?
Yes.
I think the answer to that is yes. Okay. I did want to bring in a couple of general questions. Do I understand correctly that there's going to be a rulemaking process to incorporate these changes?
In some areas, we do have to do rulemaking.
Okay.
And again, that's part of the process we're sorting through with the attorneys as we look at the law and how we need to implement. We've already discovered a number of areas where we have to do rulemaking. Rulemaking, again, takes a considerable amount of time, depending on how we walk through that and the level of effort we have. But as we go that, we'll set priorities for rulemaking as we move through, and that will affect the implementation dates of a number of provisions of the law.
One of the things I wanted to just touch on a couple of the other provisions of the Act, if we may, quickly before we wind up here. I understand three different NFIP funded grant programs have been consolidated into one program.
Yes.
Okay. And that's the severe repetitive loss, the flood
yeah.
one, and a couple of others.
Yeah, FMA, severe repetitive loss, and repetitive loss.
Very good. And apparently they've been authorized from $90 million. Is that funded out of NFIP funds, or do you have to have an appropriation for that?
No, it's funded out of the premiums and the fees that we collect.
Okay. Good deal. And is there guidance going to be coming out on that for the future.
I want to go back to that. It doesn't mean while it's funded out of there, it doesn't mean Congress doesn't have an action to take on how much money we're allowed to take out of those funds to pay for those programs. So I don't want to leave it that we just arbitrarily say we're going to put this much in. Congress has an action they have to take to give us the authorized amount that we can spend.
Got it. And again, my question is, do you expect to have some updated guidance on those programs in the future?
Yes, we do. As we consolidate and we make the offerings, you'll see some updated guidance come out on what those means, what the access is. I think what you'll see is they'll simply roll together. We'll remove the redundancies and yet retain the flexibility that's in the program.
Okay, very good. And finally, my last general question is I understand there's a new national floodplain mapping program. Can you just, you know, how does bigger waters affect the mapping, FEMA mapping?
Well, I don't know if we call it a new program. A couple of years ago, we went from map modernization to risk map, and risk map is part of that effort. We'll continue to refine and update risk map. One of the things that is provided in the law is that, and I'll probably get the name right, but there is a technical mapping council or commission that needs to be established. Frankly, it builds on a practice that we've had over the last few years. But as we go there, it is to have the discussions to, if you will, mediate mapping and the science that we apply and how we walk through that. So you'll continue to see not just FEMA's interest in there. The point is to have a non-biased group with representation from the broad community to talk about how we do maps, the science that we apply to the maps, how we view the data, and how we apply the data.
Okay, very good. I'm going to take you mentioned about the new actuarial tables. You can take this question from Ron Davis maybe as a point of departure. He asks, how will the actuarial rates be determined without calculating the first four elevations for each structure? I was wondering myself generally, are the actuarial rates uniform nationally? Are they, they're totally based on local conditions? Could you explain a little bit more of the basics on that?
Well, it just so happens that Andy Neal, one of our actuaries, just walked into the room.
All right.
and I don't know how specific we want to get, but Andy can at least give some general answers to that. Andy?
Yeah, great. Thanks for the question. And in general, right now, while we have many structures that are not elevation rated, under Bigger Waters 12, we are going to be moving most of the structures affected by the removal of subsidies, and when maps will change, those will become elevation rated. Part of that will mean that these structures will need to get elevation certificates to determine the elevation of their lowest floor or their first floor. But the question you asked about the how the rates are set and whether they are tailored to specific communities is a really good one. And the interesting thing is our rates are based on the relationship to that community's base flood elevation, so they're where their 1% risk is, and we give essentially discounts to rates as you build above that 1% chance of flooding, and we give higher rates for people who will be below that base flood elevation. But our maps allow those rates, even though they're the same nationally, to tailor to the community-specific risk profile. So you can imagine some communities have a very small special flood hazard area, and the base flood elevation isn't very high off the ground. Most of those homes will be elevated, even if they're just building in traditional techniques, not even necessarily elevated techniques, and their flood insurance premiums will be lower. You can have another community that would have a base flood elevation that's far above the ground, and so you do need to elevate, and if you don't, you have a much higher you'll have a much higher premium if you were built on the ground. So even though the rates do apply nationally, by looking at that 1% standard, then they are tailored to each community through that. And kind of let's say that David talked about the Technical Mapping Advisory Council that will be set up, and these other the sciences that we use, we're trying to make sure that they are the best sciences available to set that 1% level. And so if you elevate it exactly to the 1% level in a flood hazard area in Idaho or Florida or Alaska, no matter where, at that 1% level, we expect that you have a 1% chance of flooding and actually having your first floor start to get wet. So that gives you an indication of how it does, by using that base flood elevation, it does allow the community's risk to be tailored to the rates.
Yeah, Amy, there's one add-on to this and that I want to add, because it's part of the community dialogues that are going on now. And I know that the discussion of how those are set and how communities are rated is key, and we can get into more technical specifics on that and how we look at actuarial rates. What we want to avoid is part of what's going on now, and it's the sweeping generalizations of what premiums are going to do because you simply live in a certain zone. As Annie indicated, we're more defined than that, and we want to stay more defined in that, which means communities have to know how they sit, and individuals will need to know how they sit if they really want to know what's going to happen to their rates. A sweeping generality that says, because I live in a V-zone, I'm going to get charged an exorbitant rate, simply isn't true. It may be more the exception than the rule.
And one of the reasons we wanted to do, there's a good wrap-up, and we are going to have to close. I have put the, if folks will look in the chat, there is the address there that you can follow up with specific questions, fema-iga@fema.dhs.gov. And I had a thought, and it's completely gone out of my mind, so I guess it wasn't as important. Anyway, I do want to, I know what it was. It was the reason we wanted to do this program today was, folks, your people are going to be the ones coming to you and asking these questions, and even your, local officials, your elected officials may be coming to you to ask these questions. So we wanted to try to get the information out to you. Please do check out the links on the background page where you can find further fact sheets that may be very helpful for you to hand out to people to answer these questions. And, David, I presume there will be more information posted to that page as time goes on.
Yeah, there will. And we'll continue to work with our intergovernmental affairs people and external affairs and congressional affairs people to inform as we can. We'll put more information on our website as we move forward. And the other is hitting the regional office as well. We're sharing our information with the FEMA regional offices. They usually have the first contact in these communities as far as FEMA representation is. Don't be afraid to use them, and we'll do our best to keep them informed as well.
Very good. So on behalf of Ava Jean and myself and all our participants today, we want to thank you very much, David and Kristen. And was that Andy that chimed in there at the end?
It is.
Yes, yeah, thank you, Andy. That was very helpful.
He's the smart.
And we wish you the best because it's apparent you're going to have many challenges as this moves forward. So we wish you the best.
Thank you all.
Great. Folks, before you go, please do take a moment to give us a little bit of feedback via the form on your screen. And please take note that our next program is scheduled for April 24th. When we will feature the New England Regional Catastrophic Preparedness Initiative Cyber Disruption Planning Project. They have pioneered building a cyber disruption response capability in that area by incorporating information technology into emergency management and public safety operations. So if that's something that is interesting to you, please do make plans to join us then. Thanks to everyone for participating today. Great questions. Sorry we could not get to all of them. Again, you can follow up via the various methods that we mentioned. Again, the recording and the slides will be up later this afternoon. You'll see them linked from our homepage, and so you can access them there. Have a great afternoon, everyone. We are adjourned. Thank you. Bye-bye.